following program is brought to you by Susty Party, an online party supply store for eco-friendly party products and biodegradable compostable tableware. For more information, visit sustyparty.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby, broadcast live to the cosmos on the Heritage Radio Network.
Happy Monday afternoon, and welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby. My co-host is Sophie Schlesinger.
Hi, everyone.
We've got Joe Galarraga in the booth, making sure everything sounds good. Thank you, Joe.
Thanks, Joe.
And today's show is, last week we talked about American Cheese Month, and yep. Today we are going to be talking about British cheese versus American cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Battle Royale, if you will. No, I'm just kidding. And we're lucky to have with us Kate Arding of Culture Magazine. Thank you, Kate, for being here.
It's a very pleasure.
As you can tell by Kate's accent, she is an expert on all things British.
I'm the ultimate cheap import.
But we were just thinking of, you know, different ideas for the show, and it is kind of interesting to talk about British versus American cheese, because while there are a lot of differences, there are also a lot of similarities. So
mm-hmm.
we're just going to kind of go back and forth and talk about what makes our cheese traditions, you know, the same and different in some ways. So Kate, maybe can you lead off a little bit? What is the history of cheese in Britain? Obviously there's a renaissance that's gone on, like there has been here, but I feel like, you know, we need a little backstory.
Well, the history of cheese in Britain in 100 words. No.
Yeah.
Cheese has been around in the UK for probably a lot longer than this, but at least 400 years sort of being documented as such. And things kind of came to a big turning point with the advent of the First World War, primarily because the labour force just evaporated. Obviously, it went off to war. And although, you know, a lot of the jobs were taken by women, it really changed the face of the agricultural policy in the UK as a result. And of course, a lot of people didn't come back from the First World War, so there was a tremendous labour shortage after that, and the whole face of rural agriculture and industry was evolving very rapidly. You know, during the 20s and 30s, a lot of the large estates and farms were being broken up, and then the Second World War arrived, and with it, of course, came very strict rationing. So all the way along this sort of path, British cheeses, and especially the farmhouse cheeses, which was really all there was at that point, were suffering. And then with the advent of the Second World War and the rationing, by far the majority of the milk that had been taken and made into cheese was devoted entirely to liquid milk, because it was deemed, you know, with some reason, that was the fastest way to get nutrition to the people. I mean, cheese still was being made, but in much reduced quantities. And of course, food overall, and of course, those people listening who are familiar with British food history in its all unglorious state, that was kind of a nail in the coffin, you know, for a lot of you know, the traditional British foods, because of the shortages, and rationing in the UK actually continued in many forms until 1954. So that was 9 years after the end of the war, and when it was finally lifted at that point, what happened was that, understandably, the population just didn't want to look back. You know, they wanted to move on. They wanted to forget, you know, everything that was
All the hardship.
Exactly, and, exactly. Mm-hmm. And all the rationing and the poverty and hardship, as you say. So the feeling within the country was like, look forward, you know, modernize, you know, all this stuff, and sort of let's get rid of all the, a lot of the old stuff. I mean, I'm simplifying it, but that's generally what happened. So, and of course, commensurate with that became the sort of industrialization of food and the rise of supermarkets, which continued, you know, through the 60s and the 70s and into the 80s, of course. And all the while, that happened incrementally, farmhouse cheeses were getting sort of pushed further and further onto their back burner, because what happened was that essentially the methods of production and speed and efficiency and cheap food were eclipsing flavour. So although some of these cheeses were still being made, as they had been in the 20s and so on, the flavours were nothing like the same thing, and yet they were being called the same. So, for example, with Cheshire cheese, which is a traditional cheese from the northwest, I may have got my facts, my numbers slightly wrong, but it was something in the region of 2,000 producers who were in production in 1914, and by the early 80s, it was down to one.
Wow!
And that was farmhouse production. And what was happening, though, as I say, simultaneous to that, is that factories were starting to produce Cheshire, calling it the same thing, but of course the price was much, much, much lower, and it bore no resemblance to the original whatsoever. And that happened over many decades. So yeah, that's how the sort of potted history up until about sort of mid-80s as to where it was.
And back before the First World War, I guess, would you say most cheeses, like, were they made, you were talking about estates and such, and that's obviously something that didn't exist as much here in the U.S. Certainly yeah. There were, you know, your Robber Barons and whatnot, but were traditional British cheeses made on estates by, you know, people who were just sort of renting land from aristocrats, or were they self-made farmers, or who were
it
these
was,
people?
It was a big combination of things. I mean, obviously, there were some larger scale producers, I mean, not factory, but and some of that land would have been tenanted out by the larger farms. But also a lot of cheese making would just take place on the farm, you know, simply as a much in the same way that you'd bake bread. So there was the sort of home cheese making, if you like, which was just a means of sustenance for the farmer and his family, and maybe if they had a few extra wheels, they'd sell them at the market or something like that for extra income. But the number of real sort of commercial producers on any scale prior to sort of First World War wasn't that great. You know, in fact, we had an article in Culture magazine that was written about a year ago by Francis Percival, who is very knowledgeable on all these things, and he charted the rise of a particular style of British cheese, just colloquially known as the British crumblies, which and you know, the way that they came around, I mean, you can imagine what the texture is like, but the way they came into being was largely because it was a very slow make procedure, because it had to dovetail in with all the other chores that the farmer's wife had to do. Right. So it was not necessarily viewed with great sort of eyes towards commercial production. But that said, there were certain farms that were producing a lot, and there's some wonderful historical footage, for example, of the Cheshire cheese train, which was set off from the north of England, especially in time for Christmas.
Wow.
And of course, this was a steam train, and down the side it had these long banners going, Cheshire cheese train, and the same for Stilton too. I mean, so there was definitely, I mean, there was larger scale production, but not by what we today's standards. So.
Mm-hmm. Right. The cheese crumblies, I can't help but think, you know, I was thinking about different traditions, which we can get into later, but, you know, the cheese crumblies to cheese curds, that's something that automatically comes to my mind. The Americans and their obsession with cheese curds.
Yes, it's true.
Well, so I feel like, you know, American cheesemaking largely had its, you know, it was pretty, you know, came from pretty humble beginnings too, and then picked up a little bit when I think when America started to trade with other nations. I know there was a lot of cheese that went down to the Caribbean islands on ships. You know, that were headed down that direction. And most of those cheeses were British-style cheeses because the original settlers, you know, were, of course, from Britain.
Yeah.
And I note the first cheddar factory ever was in Rome, New York, in 1851.
Yeah, that's right.
And so, of course, leave it to the Americans to take, you know, a traditional process and mechanize it, you know, pretty much right at the onset of the Industrial Revolution. But for a while, I found it interesting that America actually exported quite a bit of cheddar cheese to Britain for a while, and it was actually quite prized.
Yes. And there's a really interesting story that I heard from Paul Kinstead, who I believe has been on your show.
Yep.
And Paul, forgive me if I get this slightly wonky, but but the tenet of the story is that of course, you know, the English arrived, you know, and brought with them, you know, originally, you know, their cheese making recipes and cheeses and so on, and set up here. And then meanwhile, what was happening in the UK was things were evolving quite rapidly, and a lot of the know-how about cheddar, traditional cheddar making, was becoming lost and you know, not destroyed exactly, but it was just morphing into a lot of things. There was this complete sort of panic, apparently, in the 18th century that they were going to lose this thing. And in fact, some of the pilgrims or their descendants from the US came back to the UK with some of the cultures to reintroduce it to England. And I may have got that slightly wrong, but that was the general impression. So actually, the English owe the Americans a great debt of gratitude. Now I have dual citizenship. I don't know who I am.
Multiple personalities.
Exactly. So who am I today? I'm not sure. But yeah, I mean, there's a very interesting relationship, you know, certainly between the UK and the States in terms of cheese making, but also, as I'm sure you may have mentioned before on the show, the patterns of immigration in the US largely reflect the styles of cheeses that have been made here. You know, for example, you know, in the Midwest, you know, you get a lot of German style and Norwegian style, Swiss.
Yeah,
exactly. So
California, tons of Italian and Spanish style cheeses.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, and it's, which is completely understandable, you know, because people want a taste of home, you know, when they go about their daily lives.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, then we had to go and muck it all up, though, because we were exporting a nice amount of good quality cheddar. And then we started adding things like, you know, vegetable oil to it. And, you know, soon this, you know, it was like the predecessor to Kraft cheese. And then it all went to hell in a handbasket. And America exported cheese to Britain no more, or in very small quantities. But
also, it's not just the Americans that messed it up. Actually, I collect some antiquarian books on cheese making, and I've got a few from the late 1700s.
Oh wow.
And what's remarkable is how little has changed in that time, really, apart from the fact that most people, at least who are living a rural peasant sort of lifestyle, would tend to eat about a pound of cheese a day. Well, hopefully. Whoa. Yeah, but then they
that's
were working
awesome. I fully admire that.
But there's one of these books which is written by a man called William Marshall, who I have to say I think was rather pompous. But what he did was he rode around England on a horse, obviously, and documented in enormous detail, you know, the goings on in the countryside, and of course paying a lot of attention to dairying and cheese making. And there's one part in one of these books where he refers, and it's written in Old English, but this bit is in large italic letters, to the crime of colouring cheese. And he says something along the lines of, thus, it is not an act of darkness done clandestinely by the dairy woman to deceive the factor, i.e. the buyer, on the contrary, it's an open and known disposition. And what he's essentially saying is that the cheesemakers are forced to colour their cheeses, which of course he considers a complete abomination, because of pressure being brought to bear on them by the distributor or the buyer. You know, and in turn, it goes all the way back to the consumer. So, I mean, nothing's changed at all.
That is very true. Yeah.
But it just sounds so much more eloquent when he wrote it than I am making it to
the
me.
Crime.
Yeah, the crime of colouring cheese. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just like the image of someone riding around on a horse, like checking up on all the cheese making that's happening.
Yes, it sounds a complete pain in the bum, actually. Yeah.
Big belly and a big book.
Yeah, exactly.
Taking notes.
Exactly.
Well, I feel like, you know, also, so we were talking about, you know, post-World Wars, food culture dramatically changing in Britain, and I think we can definitely say the same thing happened here. That idea of, although it's funny, I don't think, you know, here there wasn't the same attitude of hardship or, you know, memories of hardship. People certainly lost family members during the World Wars, but I feel like here that idea of progress was a more, like, happy, shiny, you know, leave it to beaver kind of thought process, where it was just like, why would we want to spend our time doing things like making food when we can buy this fancy machine that you plug into the wall and it'll do it for you?
Well, I think that did happen as well in the UK. I mean, certainly in the UK, they very much looked towards America as the sort of cutting edge, and they was much envied. I mean, I remember just even listening to my grandparents and it's like, oh, that's from America, you know, it's like, you know, wow, you know, and it was, I mean, it was, and that's what I'm saying, it was, so it was the combination of the two that was so seductive, I think, and wanting change and to leave this, you know, horrible past behind them, but also embrace what was sort of new and shiny,
right?
You know? And then I think also, you know, people's tastes have changed because of travel, you know, they get exposed to other other cheeses, other styles, lifestyles.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, you know, there's a constant, you know, natural human desire to sort of move forward and evolve.
Try new things.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Well, but that's something I wanted to talk about too, because a lot of the traditional British farmhouse cheeses have a very similar flavor profile to me anyways, being in that they're harder cheeses, they tend to be very tart and sharp, like, you know, Cheshire, Lancashire, you know, cheddars. Stilton is its own world. But do you think is there a specific reason that you can think of that cheesemakers favored those types of cheeses, or do you think it was just kind of the knowledge that was around at the time?
Again, I think there's not one answer to this. I think climate has a huge amount to do with it, and also the fact of wanting to store cheese during the winter, you know, for consumption. You know, when, because of the infamous rain that you get there, it's obviously conducive to storing cheese as well, because you've got that high moisture, high humidity, but you've also got the Gulf Stream, which is this weather system that comes in from the Atlantic, which keeps the temperatures temperate, you know, but not as warm as, say, France, or at least the sort of, not the, the non-mountainous regions. So you don't get the extremes of temperature, or at least you didn't used to.
Yeah, right.
that you would get it towards the Mediterranean. So I think these cheeses, they're sort of rather, I think rather symbolic of a British character. You know, they're rather sort of solid and round and don't get perturbed easily, you know.
So, they have a nice bite to them.
Exactly, that ironic dry.
Witty dry bite.
So I think, yes, I mean, and also many of the areas in the UK are very, particularly in the north and the Midlands, very rich in minerals. So you get a lot of minerality coming through in some of those flavours. And again, I just think a lot of it's climate related, because obviously we're talking about days pre-refrigeration.
Yeah.
So they were much more subject to the sort of vagaries of temperature and humidity than we are now.
And then if they had to be transported from rural areas to market, which would be presumably in big cities, they would have to be tough cheeses,
exactly.
You know, that could withstand the journey.
Exactly.
Because a truckload of camemberts in the 1800s must have, you know, that would be an impossibility.
Right.
It would be a runny, stinky mess.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yes, which is why the British always mistrusted the French.
Yeah.
A lot of stinky
they
cheeses.
Smell funny.
Yeah. It's foreign. Yeah.
But so lead us, so you've guided us through sort of, you know, the older historical parts of British cheesemaking, and now can we talk a little bit more about how some of those farmhouse cheeses were saved, and then also sort of the influx of new cheeses being made in Britain?
Well, I think the, the story for me anyway sort of starts with a man called Patrick Rance, who was an extraordinary character who wrote two really, well, one certainly very definitive book on French cheese.
That's an awesome book.
Which is an amazing book.
Yeah.
And then also a book on British cheese, which is slightly less well known. But he was a tremendous champion of traditional cheese production at a time when nobody else was, and during the sort of 70s and into the early 80s. And he sadly died at the end of the 80s. But he met Randolph Hodgson, who he's owned and ran and still runs Neal's Yard Dairy. And he kind of picked up the gauntlet on this, aged about 20. And he knew and worked with Patrick Rance for a number of years. They colluded together on this project, and what they did, what Patrick Rance did, was he really drew Randolph's attention to the fact that a lot of these farmhouse cheeses were on the verge of disappearing. Some had already had. So Randolph, he had this tiny, tiny cheese shop. You can relate, I think.
Might have been tinier. Yeah, yeah. In that little,
that
it's
original
like
one, yeah.
Harry Potter,
yeah.
You know? Like you find this magical little alley.
Exactly. It's just incredible. So he started off literally by going around the country and knocking on farmhouse doors. And, you know, that was how he learnt, for example, about Kirkham's Lancashire, which was in within weeks of going out of business as the last sort of cloth-wrapped Lancashire that was coated in butter. And then also as he sort of started to go out and find these producers, some of them arrived, you know, they got word of what he was trying to do. And in fact, there's this lovely story of the Appleby family who make this Cheshire that I was referring to earlier, arriving down in London with a 40-pound wheel of cloth-wrapped Cheshire and slamming it down, as I think you would, with 40-pound Cheshire on the counter, and saying to Randolph, "Here, try that, lad," you know, and meaning that, you know, you just hadn't tasted anything like it. So that was the very sort of small beginnings. But the point that it kind of comes to, which I think is always worth bearing in mind, whatever food we're talking about, is that a lot of the attention, you know, understandably gets focused on the producers, because that's the sort of romantic end of it, you know, and that's the bit that we all kind of aspire towards, mm-hmm. I think. But you can be making the best cheese in the world, or the best anything, you know, in the world, but unless you have the other points or the other links in the chain in place, i.e. the retailer who's going to be an advocate for the producer and then acts as the translator to the consumer.
And the means of getting it from where you make it.
Exactly, and the distributors and the educators. I mean, all these things have to be in alignment in order to make it work. And one can't really work without the other, at least on this scale of operations. So the reason, really, that, at least in my mind, that the cheeses started to recover and sort of gain a toehold again in the market was the fact that the market started to exist again. So it wasn't as if the people had gone away, but as Randolph once explained, what had happened was that the brokers were telling the cheesemakers, the traditional cheesemakers, that there was no longer a market for their cheese because it was hard to handle and it lost weight and
it was more expensive.
Exactly, all these things. And at the same time, they were telling the public or the retailers that that sort of cheese was no longer available. So really, it was the brokers who were the evil ones.
Evil merchants.
In this instance, there's great, tremendous progress, she hastily adds. Yeah. So, but that was the thing. And because people's sense of flavors had changed because of these incremental differences over decades, they had sort of forgotten that the quote-unquote Cheshire cheese that was the factory-produced version was miles away from the original farmhouse version or whatever cheese it was.
Mm.
So it sort of, once those sort of things started getting into sync again, that was what paved the way for the progress. So,
And now there are all these new cheesemakers, which is very similar to what we see in America. I mean, I would say, you know, there are probably a very small handful of cheesemakers that managed to survive from, say, the early 1900s until now in the United States. But starting in the 90s, really, we saw such an explosion of small artisan cheesemakers that continues to grow each year to this day.
Right.
And I feel like you also in Britain have quite a few new cheesemakers in addition to people who are upholding those older traditions.
Definitely, and for the same reasons that I just mentioned, because there was a market. You know, suddenly there was a market and there was a demand, which made, you know, for younger people, well, not necessarily just younger, but, you know, people who were interested in producing cheese, it meant that they had a viable income again. You know, they weren't just sort of making cheese and giving it away so that they could actually make a living, you know, because at the end of the day, however sort of subsistence level one, you know, one has to pay the bills at some point. So that was really what encouraged, and also again, you know, just increased awareness on the part of the consumer. You know, media had a tremendous amount, or has a tremendous amount to do with it. The traveling that I mentioned earlier, you know, people go away and they try these things. It's like, ooh, you know.
So,
yeah, exactly. So it's all these sort of factors come together. It's been very exciting to watch it, actually.
Yeah, yeah. It's fantastic. Well, you got to witness it in London with Neil Jarre Dairy and then witness it again with Cowgirl Creamery out here in California.
Yeah, I was just really lucky to be in the right place at the right time. I mean, whereas, as you said earlier, you know, in the UK, we were trying to preserve these traditions. It was also really interesting to be in the US and see them essentially starting from the carte blanche, you know, and also because the US is much less constrained by tradition, you know, actively so, as we know historically.
Yeah.
So it's really fascinating to me. I mean, aside from the tendency that we mentioned earlier with the immigration patterns and so on, but you know, what do you start, you know, what happens when you sort of throw all the cards up in the air? You know, it's been fantastic, you know, and the thing that staggers me is the meteoric rise of cheese here. And I don't think that could really happen to the extent it's happened in any other country, because I think one of the things that's so refreshing, and it's a cliche, but it's so refreshing about the US is people's willingness to try new stuff, whether that's somebody wanting to get into cheesemaking,
a new career,
or to literally taste a new cheese during American Cheese Month. So it's that willingness to embrace change, I think, which is terrific, and that is different from Europe. I mean, the Europeans are getting much better at it, but you know, there's still that sort of, ooh, it might taste funny, I'm not sure about that one, you know, whereas the Americans are like, yeah, I'll give it a try, you know.
It's got what on it? All right. Exactly. Sign me up.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, maybe we're almost out of time, which is very sad because this is a fascinating conversation and we should definitely have a part two.
Part two, yeah.
But I feel like we could leave off. You told a really interesting story. Kate and I were at the Connecticut Cheese and Wine Festival last weekend, you told a very fascinating story about some cross-pollination, literally, between Stilton and Mount Tam. So,
well, we thought it was cross-pollination.
Which it could be.
Yeah, it could have been. It could have been. But Yes, this was at Cowgirl Creamery in the early days. So this was probably about 1998 or 99. And as I'm sure many people listening will know, that Cowgirl Creamery produces a range of sort of soft, fresh cheeses. And one of the first cheeses that they made was this one called Mount Tam, which is a triple cream, you know, bloomy rinded
butter with cheese. A rind.
Yeah, it is actually. It's very, very good. And so at the time, I was running the retail side there, and Sue Connolly, one of the owners of Cowgirl, was making the cheese, and we were sharing this tiny walk-in refrigerator. You know, so at the end of the day, I'd sort of, you know, take down a display and put everything in the walk-in fridge, and you know, she would be trying to age cheeses in bus tubs in the fridge at the same time. And anyway, I was setting up one morning, and Sue came stomping across the hallway, and there was this look of thunder on her face, which she never or very rarely gets. I mean, it's like, it's quite, and for that fact alone, it was quite alarming. And so she said, you know, take a look at these. And she sort of opened this bus tub, and inside were these very pink, not white, pink Mount Tams. And she said, your Stiltons, because this was, I just got a big Stilton delivery in, your Stiltons have contaminated my Mount Tams. And I said, oh my God, you know. So anyway, she said, I've been washing them and washing them in salt water, and you know, this mold won't come off, and I don't know what it is. And she, I mean, there was steam just coming out of her ears. And and I sort of said, well, have you tasted it? And so we did, and it was, of course, delicious. And what she'd been doing, you know, I hope she won't mind me telling this story, but what she'd been doing was washing these cheeses with salt water, which is the one thing that this bacteria called bacterium, or Brevibacterium linens, B linens for short, loves salt water. So of course she thought she was trying to get rid of this bacteria, and in fact she was encouraging it. And so yeah, that was the formation of Red Hawk, the original formation of Red Hawk, which of course now is one of their biggest sellers.
It's an amazing cheese.
It is. But what we subsequently found out, I mean, there I was thinking, uh-oh, these Stiltons are all, you know, responsible for a whole bunch of trouble. But actually later we found out, I can't remember quite how now, but that there's a natural strain of this bacteria which comes down the coast at a certain time of year. So essentially it was in the microflora in the atmosphere, and maybe the Stiltons gave it a shove, I don't know. But
I like to think that the Stiltons gave it a shove.
Sort of colonization of a different sort, isn't
it? Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Oh, well, thank you so much, Kate, for being on the show. It's
fun.
Been a long time in the making, and I'm so happy that we got you down here in the studio.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yes, and we'll definitely, hopefully you'll be back with us. Hopefully you'll be willing to take the trip back down to Brooklyn.
If I play my cards right.
Yeah. Well, thank you everyone for listening in. We'll be back next Monday with another episode of Cutting the Curd. And till then, stay cheesy.
You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today.
Thanks for listening.